KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Donald Trump is making his mark on the Justice Department. Attorney General Pam Bondi is in, senior career officials are out, and a weaponization working group has launched. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. How are Gaza's neighbors reacting to President Trump's call for Palestinians to leave Gaza and the U.S. to take over? I mean, Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We talk with a former Egyptian foreign minister and ambassador to the U.S. Plus, no explosions, no car chases, just a real story about the real feelings of two girls growing up in South Dakota. We talk with the director and star of Jazzy. It is Friday, February 7th. 2 years ago today, LeBron James passed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to become the NBA's all-time career scoring leader. Last night, he scored 42 points, and yes, he's 40 years old. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Unions representing federal workers are suing the Trump administration for its efforts to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Aid. USAID says nearly all of its staff will be put on leave, except around 300 workers deemed essential. Russia, meanwhile, is welcoming the decision to sharply curtail American foreign aid projects, as NPR's Charles Maines reports.
The Kremlin has long claimed USAID is merely a front for American efforts to overthrow Moscow-friendly governments in the former Soviet space. And it was in that context that Russia's foreign ministry celebrated USAID's cutbacks. Speaking to journalists, spokesperson Maria Zakharova said USAID was, quote, anything but an aid and development agency, instead calling it a machine for promoting regime change. Critics of the Trump administration's decision say USAID's demise would be a gift to autocrats everywhere. The Kremlin banned USAID's work inside Russia way back in 2012. It went on to pass a so-called foreign agents law used to persecute human rights groups and other critical voices that received outside funding. Charles Maines, NPR News.
Panama has told China that it will withdraw from Beijing's Belt and Road Infrastructure Initiative amid pressure from the U.S. to curb China's influence over the Panama Canal. NPR's John Ruich has more.
Panama's President José Raúl Mulino says his ambassador in Beijing has already given the Chinese government 90 days notice of his country's intent to leave the Belt and Road Initiative. Panama was the first Latin American country to join the plan after it switched diplomatic recognition to China from Taiwan in 2017. Mulino said it was his decision to withdraw, but the announcement comes after a visit to the Central American country by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who pressured Panama to decrease China's influence over the strategically important Panama Canal. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Lin Jian said Beijing deeply regrets Panama's decision, and China opposes U.S. pressure and coercion to smear and sabotage the Belt and Road Initiative. John Ruich, NPR News, Beijing.
And President Trump will talk with Panama's president by phone later today. He's about to meet with the Japanese prime minister in Washington in about a half an hour. More large companies in the U.S. are eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. NPR's Maria Aspen reports companies scrubbed some or all of their DEI language from annual reports.
A few of these companies referred specifically to President Trump's new executive orders ending DEI in the federal government. These orders also threaten to sanction private companies that are federal contractors that have what Trump called illegal DEI programs. And Google, for example, is a federal contractor. A spokesperson this week told me that Google is evaluating the changes required by Trump's executive orders, and Google, I should note, is one of NPR's funders.
NPR's Maria Aspen reporting. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Scientists and public health leaders are taking stock of the Trump administration's abrupt decision to pull down web pages, data sets, and selected information from federal health websites. Some of the pages on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website that went offline last week, though, have since reappeared. But as NPR's Will Stone reports, the full impact isn't yet clear.
Some websites with data on infectious diseases or guidelines for clinicians have reappeared, but researchers are busy trying to figure out what has changed or disappeared. In some cases, links are broken or words have been scrubbed. The purge of the website and data was prompted by President Trump's executive orders on gender and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Dr. Nirav Shah sits on a CDC advisory committee that is seeking answers from the agency's acting director.
This is completely unprecedented. These data sets are more than statistics. They're our early warning system.
Opposition to the website changes has come from across the medical and scientific community, and a progressive group representing physicians is now suing some federal health agencies. Will Stone, NPR News.
The U.S. economy added fewer jobs than expected last month. The Labor Department says 143,000 jobs were created in January. That's slower than the previous 2 months. The unemployment rate fell to 4%. Hiring last month was concentrated in healthcare, retail, and government jobs, while factory and construction companies added relatively few new jobs in January. Average wages, though, last month were up 4.1% from a year ago. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Egypt is pushing back hard against President Trump's proposal to remove Palestinians from the Gaza Strip and develop the Mediterranean enclave. The country shares a border with the territory and a peace deal with Israel that has been in place for nearly 50 years. So now our key question about this idea is whether that peace deal might be at risk. To learn more about this, we call up Nabil Fahmy. He is a former Egyptian foreign minister and a former ambassador to the United States. Good morning, Minister. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
So given your understanding of the sort of the dynamics in both countries, I just wanted to ask how you reacted when you first heard of this idea.
Sure. I wasn't surprised that there was a desire to displace the Palestinians, because that's been the position of the Israeli right for generations. But I was flabbergasted that the U.S. president would embrace a proposal that is illegal, impractical, politically, and unapplicable. And my reasons for that are quite simple. The U.S. is the permanent member of the Security Council and, if you want, the main superpower. And you have a responsibility to respect international law. But I would add to that, that it is really impossible to expect Palestinians, after 70 years of occupation, to hand over their territories peacefully to a third party, in this case, the U.S. And finally, the idea is that all of this would be done by Arabs, financed by Arabs. It's just illogical.
So the Trump administration has walked back some of this, saying the Palestinians would only be temporarily relocated, that no U.S. troops would be involved. Does that change anything? Does this ameliorate any of the alarm or outrage that has been sparked by this?
No, not at all, because in essence, the Palestinians don't want to leave the territory. They want to return to Gaza, and we are ready, and we're going to convene a conference for this purpose. We are ready to help them do that. It's going to be difficult, and it's going to cost a lot of money, but it cannot be isolated from the political desire to have their own state or to live beyond the Israeli occupation.
What steps is Egypt taking to try to sort of intervene in this thinking? Are they communicating with the Trump administration directly to register objections to this? What steps is Egypt doing?
Definitely so. President Sisi has issued a statement personally about this. The foreign minister, Abdelati, is coming to Washington in a day or two. And we are in touch, of course, internationally with a number of international players. Again, it's not an anti-anything. It is a pro-peace approach, which requires all of us to respect international law and to fulfill the political rights of all the parties in the region. And that's why we have continued to support the very difficult process, but the only option available, which is a two-state solution.
Would this plan, if the Trump administration were to seriously pursue it, would this affect Egypt's peace deal with Israel, which, as we said, has been in place for nearly half a century?
Well, again, there's no better source on this than the president, our president itself. His public statement says this would threaten our national security. That's the answer to that question.
The Associated Press is reporting that Israel is reportedly already preparing for the departure of Palestinians from Gaza. And this was reported just after President Trump made this announcement. I'm trying to understand what would happen if Palestinians were to be forced to evacuate from Gaza, even temporarily. Like, where would they go?
I think the report you mentioned is correct. And that's why I said at the beginning, I'm not surprised that this idea keeps coming up. The Israeli approach is let them leave anywhere, but ultimately the Israeli traditional position is have them move to Arab countries, especially Jordan. And that's really where the right keeps pushing.
So you don't think that Egypt is a target for this, even this temporary resettlement? Because I think people may remember that Egypt closed its borders with Gaza at certain points to keep presumably refugees from coming out.
Oh, I think it's a target. And that's why President Sisi said our national security is threatened here. But I also think that the biggest target is Jordan, and that's a threat to Jordan's national security.
Why is it seen that way?
Well, the Jordanians, of course, have a very large number of citizens of Palestinian origin already. If you're going to add greater numbers that change the demographic structure of the country, then that's a threat to their national security. We have consistently argued that we want peace between Arabs and Israelis, and that involves enabling the Palestinians to have their nation state. So we're not going to directly or implicitly engage and support a process that forces Palestinians out.
That is Nabil Fahmy. He's a former Egyptian foreign minister. He's a former ambassador to the United States, and we reached him in Cairo. Minister Fahmy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Most welcome, Michelle. Thank you.
This week, the Senate voted to confirm Pam Bondi as President Trump's new attorney general.
Bondi takes over at the Justice Department as the Trump administration makes aggressive moves to take over the federal bureaucracy. Over the past few weeks, the new administration has already pushed out senior career officials at the department and at the FBI, setting off fears about mass firings.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has been following this. Ryan, let's start with the new Attorney General, Pam Bondi, sworn in this week in the Oval Office by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. So now that she's on the job, what has she done?
Well, one of the first things that she did was sign a whole bunch of memos, more than a dozen of them, that aim to advance the president's agenda and the department's role in it. These things address a whole range of topics. Bondi revived the federal death penalty. She set up an October 7th task force to focus on the threat posed by Hamas. Other memos address immigration enforcement, the drug cartels. This sort of thing reflects the shift in priorities that we often see out of the Justice Department with the change in administration. Saying that, though, there's one memo in particular that really stood out, and it raises questions about whether the department under Bondi aims to go after the people who investigated Trump.
Tell us about that memo.
Well, the subject line is restoring the integrity and credibility of the Department of Justice. But what the memo does is establish what it calls a weaponization working group that will review the criminal and civil cases that were brought against Trump over the past 4 years by federal and state prosecutors. It will also look at the Capitol riot investigations and what the memo calls the pursuit of improper investigative tactics and unethical prosecutions relating to the Capitol attack. Now, Bondi has been a fierce defender of Trump over the years. Before she was attorney general, she talked about investigating the investigators, and there are certainly concerns that that's what's going on here. And look, in the past few weeks, the department has already fired more than a dozen prosecutors who worked on Trump investigations because the new leadership said those folks couldn't be trusted to carry out the president's agenda.
Yeah, there's also been turmoil at the FBI. So where do things stand now?
Right. There's been a lot of nervousness and fear at the FBI over the past week. Remember, the FBI falls under the authority of the Justice Department. But the panic at the FBI started after the number two official at the Justice Department ordered the firing of eight senior career FBI officials, and at the same time demanded a list of all FBI personnel who worked on any January 6th case. That's around 5,000 FBI employees in all. Now, that set off fears at the FBI of possible mass firings. Sources told me about FBI agents printing out their HR files because they were worried that they'd be fired immediately. They wouldn't have access to the system. Things have settled down a bit in the past few days. The FBI handed over a list of employees who worked January 6 cases, but not the agents' names, to the Justice Department. The department says this is part of a review process related to ending what it calls the weaponization of the justice system. There are still concerns, though, about FBI agents' names possibly being made public, and then they or their families facing threats. Remember, Trump pardoned some 1,500 January 6 defendants, including people who were convicted of violence. Agents have actually filed two lawsuits to try to prevent agents' names from being made public. So there's a lot of concern here. There's a court hearing scheduled on those lawsuits today, so there will certainly be more to come.
Yeah, that's NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks for breaking it all down.
Thank you.
President Trump signed an executive order this week that seeks to ban transgender women from playing women's sports in schools that receive federal funding. It's just one of multiple actions aimed at ending what the administration calls gender ideology. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports.
Gender ideology became one of Trump's favorite slogans on the campaign trail.
I will take historic action to defeat the toxic poison of gender ideology and reaffirm that God created two genders, male and female.
Now the administration is trying to put a political phrase into practice. On day one, Donald Trump signed an order that, among other things, calls to end funding for, quote, gender ideology. Harper Seldon, a senior staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, says the phrase is harmful, implying a belief system rather than an identity.
If we had an executive order that said the left-handed ideology, people would understand immediately that that was not quite right. Being left-handed is just a natural variation, and same with being transgender.
The Trump administration's definition of gender ideology negates the idea that gender identity is separable from sex as they define it. Seldon sees the definition as intentionally loose, allowing the government to discriminate. Jay Richards, a senior research fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, says the focus on gender ideology is about keeping women and girls safe.
The concern is, especially with children and especially in private women's spaces and in particular, I think, women's prisons, the categories of gender ideology have started to dissolve the clear distinction between the biological sexes.
He points to instances where women in prison have accused transgender women inmates of abuse. However, studies have also shown transgender inmates are at a higher risk of violence. Already, the executive order is sparking confusion. A mental health provider with the VA spoke to NPR anonymously for fear of retaliation. They pointed to a memo saying employees whose jobs include, quote, promoting gender ideology should be put on paid leave. The provider said, when we read that, we were like, what does that mean? Is that any of us? Or because of the way our profession looks at gender, is that all of us? They also fear that if policy inhibits mental health care, suicide rates among transgender patients could rise. A White House spokesperson told NPR that they stand by their definition. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interviews with singer Marianne Faithfull, who was discovered at a Rolling Stones party in 1964, recorded As Tears Go by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and later became Jagger's girlfriend. After drug addiction and homelessness, she bounced back to become a smoky voiced interpreter of dark, moody songs. Join us. I sit down.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. There are plenty of films that have kids in them, but how many of them are really about kids, what they think, how they feel? A new film by director Marissa Maltz, Jazzy, really is about its main subjects, best friends Jazzy and Soraya.
Here's the reason why you shouldn't grow up. When you grow up, you're going to have to go to work. When you go to work, you'll be tired. When you're tired, you'll want to go home. When you go home, then your boss gets mad. When your boss gets mad, you're fired. When you're fired, you don't work. But when you don't work, you don't get money. When you don't get money, then you'll be homeless. When you're homeless, you'll be hungry. When you're hungry, you'll die.
I don't want to talk about this anymore. Growing up sounds ugly.
Well, when you put it that way, growing up does sound ugly, which may be one reason why the film takes a gentle and meandering look at two young girls and their friends as they navigate friendship, family, heritage, and yes, growing up in South Dakota. Joining us to tell us more about Jazzy is the star of the film, Jasmine Bearkiller Shangru, and director Marissa Maltz. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So Marissa, I'm going to start with you. This film isn't so much a follow-up as it grows out of your debut film, The Unknown Country. Jasmine made an appearance in that film. What made you think to focus your next film on her?
I mean, to put it simply, like, we all fell in love with Jazzy and we grew incredibly close while making The Unknown Country. It was a very small team. It took many years. It was hard to make. And Jazzy was so amazing in the few moments that she's in the film, and she was so captivating. And it was sort of a natural progression that we thought, oh, well, why don't we keep working with Jazzy, you know, instead of just ending it at The Unknown Country.
So when Marissa told you that she wanted to make a film that was focused on you, what did you think?
I was kind of confused at first. I don't really remember much because I was little, but the more I, like, grew up while acting and, like, I really found an interest in it and I really liked it.
So, Marissa, it's not a documentary, but it kind of feels like one. Kind of like if you've seen any of those POV films on PBS, those point of view films on PBS. I'm trying to describe it, so why don't I, instead of me describing it, why don't you describe it?
Sure. So I live about half the year in South Dakota, you know, a few minutes away from Jazzy. So she would come over after school or we would go get ice cream when she was younger. Now it's turned into nail dates. And so the film really sort of came out of the stories that she was telling from school, watching how deeply, you know, kids get affected by what's happening around them. That's why it feels natural, is because these are also, like, inspired by real stories.
Well, yes, of course, absolutely. Lily Gladstone is part of the cast and one of the executive producers. She is the first Native American to be nominated for Best Actress at the Academy Awards for her role in Killers of the Flower Moon. She also starred in your previous film, The Unknown Country. I don't think she was famous then. Am I right about that? I mean, she wasn't famous. Like, she's super famous now. Was it different working with her on the second film from the first?
It was a little different because in The Unknown Country, the first part, I was young. I didn't really get to be that close to her because it wasn't my movie. In the Jazzy movie, I got to be more with her. She gave me, like, tips and stuff for acting and really inspired me to do well.
Is that Isaac?
Yep.
Isn't he your boyfriend or something? I don't know, I heard someone gossiping.
I'm not surprised.
Actually, I got asked out by my friend Landon a few days ago.
Really? Mm-hmm. What'd you say?
I rejected him. Oh, God. He'll get over it. It sucks for him, though, but I'm just trying to keep all my friends. I don't want to lose any, so, yeah.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
Well, whether he or somebody else someday is your boyfriend, the important part is that they're your friend.
But honestly, up until the introduction of Gladstone's character, the kids really are at the center of everything. And in fact, the adults' faces are often out of frame. That obviously says something. What are you saying?
So I remember when I was a child looking up and seeing my parents' faces for the first time when they were describing a close family member that passed away. And that's my first memory of really seeing their faces. And so I feel like that formative experience of learning about death is something that, like, as a kid, it's one of those things that just suddenly makes you feel a little more grown up. And so we decided to sort of use that as the moment when you really see adults for the first time in the film.
I'm glad you mentioned that scene, because two things play a big role here. It's the world of kids, but it's also culture, and it's also the landscape. The girls reunite for a relative's funeral toward the end of the film, where many of the Lakota traditions take center stage, and you also really see a lot of the landscape, and that really feels like almost like a character in the film. So I wanted to ask about that, like, why, Marissa, was that important to you to include those traditions and also that framing and that really expansive and really gorgeous scenery, I have to say.
Jazzy's whole family, extended family, sort of planned that scene. I'd love to give Jazzy an opportunity to answer that.
It was important because, like, it references our culture, but it can also, like, teach something to other people who don't know much about Native Americans, only know the stuff they know from school. It could really teach them more about Native Americans so they could know how it is for them.
Okay, so Jasmine, I want to give you the final word. What do you hope that people seeing this movie will take away from it?
Maybe some of, like, the younger adults, maybe, or, like, anybody, basically. I hope they can somehow relate to it from when they were a kid, or maybe, like, from the stuff they see, they can know, hey, this is, like, I've been through that before, and I relate to it, and I just hope they find the movie comforting, and they just, like, enjoy the nice aesthetic scenery of it.
That is Jasmine Bearkiller Shangru. She stars in the new film by director Marissa Maltz. Their new film, Jazzy, is in theaters today. Thank you both so much for joining us, and special thanks to you, Jasmine, for taking some time on a school day to talk with us. I hope you didn't miss too much.
No, I didn't. It's fine. I already told my teachers about it.
And Marissa, thank you so much for talking to us, too.
Thank you so much for having us. I'm really grateful.
This is NPR News.
President Trump began his second term with a dramatic crackdown on immigration. His critics call these plans cruel and unnecessary, but many of his supporters are applauding these early steps.
We are thankful that Donald Trump is taking action against illegal immigration.
I'm Elsa Chang. Trump supporters talk about his early immigration policies on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is winding down his visit to the United States with arms sales commitments and backing from Republican allies in the White House and Congress.
The American-Israeli alliance has never been stronger. I'm now completing a week in which began with an extraordinary meeting with President Trump. And under his leadership, the critical decisions that show his commitment and the American people's commitment to Israel have come to the fore instantly.
Netanyahu addressing reporters this morning during a joint news conference with House Speaker Mike Johnson. Neither addressed President Trump's proposal Tuesday to relocate Palestinians from Gaza and have the U.S. take control of the Palestinian territory. A ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza began several weeks ago. The first big jobs report for 2025 shows the U.S. economy gained a lower than expected 143,000 jobs during the Biden-Trump transition in January. The unemployment rate fell to 4%. Tens of thousands of federal government jobs are on the line. NPR's Domenico Montanaro offers a snapshot of President Trump's third week in office.
DOGE, this informal Department of Government efficiency, has been at multiple agencies accessing records, including sensitive payment information at the Treasury Department. And there's this effort to get federal workers to resign by, quote, deferred resignation, essentially a buyout.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro. You're listening to NPR News. Bangladesh is confronting a series of attacks on supporters of ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. Reporter Omkar Kandekar says Hasina had previously called on people to resist the interim government of Nobel Peace Laureate Muhammad Yunus.
Thousands of protesters cheered on Wednesday night as a crane rammed through the house of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, founding leader of Bangladesh and father of the ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. By Friday, local newspaper The Daily Star was reporting attacks on members of her Awami League party in more than two dozen cities. Another newspaper, Pratham Olo, reported crowds using excavators to demolish a building owned by Hasina's family. Human Rights Watch has said the interim government should seek the support of the United Nations to stop, quote, the cycle of violence and revenge. The press wing of Muhammad Yunus has called for calm but blamed Hasina for provoking the protesters. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
Amazon is reporting better than expected revenue and profits during the holiday shopping season that closed out 2024. Today, the e-retail tech and digital streaming company had disclosed it. Fourth quarter revenue came in at $187.8 billion, 10% higher than a year earlier. Amazon is projecting lower revenue this quarter. Amazon is a contributor to NPR programming. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Tonight, thousands of people who work for USAID will be forced to go on leave as the Trump administration continues to gut the agency that provides humanitarian assistance all over the world. Now, this comes 2 weeks after the U.S. froze nearly all foreign assistance, including food. So how is that affecting the fight against hunger globally? Eugene Cho joins us now. He's president of Bread for the World. It's a Christian organization based in the U.S. that advocates for policies to end hunger. Eugene, so how important is USAID to global food security?
Well, thanks for having me. USAID is the largest and the most impactful humanitarian agency funded by U.S. taxpayers. It's the most impactful agency in the world. And so for it not to be working as intended is obviously going to have an impact on hunger globally. And I say this acknowledging that there are about 750 million people that experience hunger around the world, including 45 million children that suffer from something called wasting, which is the most dangerous form of malnutrition. We are very, very concerned.
So are you worried that lives are at stake here?
Absolutely. We know that lives will be in jeopardy. Soon we'll learn more, but all the reports that we're hearing from our implementing partners are very dangerous stories because systems have been shut down and people are unable to do the work that they were contracted to do through the USAID.
What is happening then to all the aid that was maybe in transit or put in storage in recent weeks? Is it just going to sit there?
There are stories about essential medicines that are expiring in the Democratic Republic of the Congo after a cash-strapped government contractor was forced to shut off its air conditioning. And so there's concerns about the life-saving antibiotics and the anti-malarial drugs. There are stories about certain food. This particular story comes from a woman named Gina Perry, who leads a human health program for the American Soybean Association, which is an industry trade group. And so there's 33,000 metric tons of soybeans and soy products, which is used to treat severe malnutrition in East Africa, other regions. And unfortunately, these shipping containers full of these materials en route have had to be diverted to warehouses or worse, held at ports. Basically, there's no instructions on what they're supposed to do.
Eugene, the Government Accountability Office has recommended changes to USAID's Global Hunger Initiative over the years. It noted lack of performance goals, problems with transparency. Are you at all sympathetic to the need for this oversight?
So, Bread for the World, we are an advocacy organization. We don't receive a single dollar from the U.S. government. And so it's really important for us. For myself personally, as a fiscal conservative, I am very happy when there are conversations about more transparency, more efficiency. But to suggest that we have to shut down the entire system in order for that to take place is not only ludicrous, it's incredibly dangerous. And I would say unfair because it happened literally overnight without warning.
Eugene Cho is president of Bread for the World. Eugene, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The U.S. Constitution assigns Congress the job of deciding how to spend taxpayer money. In the last couple of weeks, President Trump and Elon Musk have effectively grabbed the legislative branch's power of the purse through executive action. As NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh reports, so far, Republicans on Capitol Hill are not putting up a fight.
House Speaker Mike Johnson insists he's a fierce defender of Congress's Article I authority to steer where federal dollars go. But when it comes to President Trump's recent actions,
the executive branch of government in our system has the right to evaluate how executive branch agencies are operating.
A week before Elon Musk and his government efficiency unit known as DOGE moved to shutter the foreign aid agency USAID, Trump's Office of Management and Budget team directed a pause on all federal grants. Lawmakers fielded calls from constituents worried that daycare programs, Meals on Wheels, and other community programs would stop operating. A few Republicans publicly voiced concerns about the freeze, but the speaker downplayed the effort.
I think this is something that the American people will approve of. I think they want us to be good stewards of the precious treasure of the American taxpayer.
Shortly after the speaker's remarks, a federal court shut down the Trump administration's pause on grants. Democrats say both executive moves are illegal. NPR asked the number two Senate Republican John Barrasso if he thinks Trump and DOGE are overstepping congressional authority.
No, I don't. I think that the administration has every right to demand accountability and transparency in all these programs.
North Carolina Republican Tom Tillis says he believes an executive unilaterally shutting down USAID does step on the separation of powers.
I think that runs afoul of the Constitution in the strictest sense.
But he argued that former President Joe Biden took similar steps and shrugged about what's happening in the early days of the Trump administration.
It's not uncommon for presidents to flex a little bit on where they can spend and where they can stop spending.
And he says this dynamic is not new.
There's a lot of people in the past that conveyed that power over to a Democrat president or a Republican president, and they're pushing the envelopes of what that power looks like. It's a normal part of a transition.
But one new wrinkle in this power struggle between two branches is Musk. The richest man in the world is now a government employee with unprecedented influence. Senator Susan Collins, who chairs the panel that decides how much money federal agencies get, said the abrupt decision to fold USAID into the State Department sidestepped Congress's role.
The law is very specific that if there's going to be a reorganization of USAID, that Congress has to be informed 15 days in advance.
DOGE targeting foreign aid as its first place to cut was not a big political problem for Republicans. They say Americans are skeptical about how much is being spent overseas. Another Republican on the committee in charge of spending, Arkansas Senator John Bozeman, admits lawmakers don't know the details yet about Musk's plans across federal agencies.
I don't think we know exactly what he is doing right now.
But soon the debate will be much broader and involve programs Republicans lobbied for that help their own constituents. On March 14th, all federal agencies will run out of money unless Congress passes a new funding bill. It's unclear what the president and Musk will want in that legislation, but so far, most Republicans aren't willing to get crosswise with them, even if it means ceding their own power. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is NPR News.
Mexico is the largest source of food imports to the U.S., so you can imagine the reaction of vegetable importers at the border to Trump's threatened trade war. That's next time on Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Martin. The legendary jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald has a new single out today, Let's Do It, her playful take on the Cole Porter classic. Okay, so it's not actually new. It's a release from a long-lost live concert album recorded in June 1967 at the Oakland Coliseum. The tapes were recently unearthed in the private collection of the founder of Verve Records. The new remixed album is out on February 28th. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. On Sunday, 1 week removed from winning 5 Grammy Awards, Kendrick Lamar will meet the biggest single audience he has ever had as the featured performer at the Super Bowl halftime show.
They not like us. They not like us. They not like us.
Now, details about this show are scarce. I mean, they're keeping just about everything close to the vest. But Sydney Madden of NPR Music is here to talk about just how big of a moment this is. So, Sydney, I mean, Kendrick gave a pre-show interview down in New Orleans. What did he reveal about Sunday?
Not too much. What we do know is Kendrick will be the first solo rapper to take over America's biggest stage, and he's bringing at least one confirmed guest with him. That's R&B superstar SZA, who's one of his longtime collaborators. When he was asked what fans can expect from the show, here's what he said.
Storytelling. I think I've always been very open about storytelling through all my catalog and my history of music. And I've always had a passion about bringing that on whatever stage I'm on, that sense of, you know, make people listen, but also see and think a little.
Everyone is still wondering whether or not Kendrick will perform one specific song on Sunday, and that's his 2024 hit diss track, Not Like Us. That's because that track is part of an ongoing lawsuit filed by another rapper, Drake. Drake, who is the target of the diss track, has accused Universal Music Group of defaming him by distributing the song.
I wonder if Drake is almost wants to dare Kendrick to do it. You know, I don't know.
Lawyers on the phone.
I know, right? I mean, he won a bunch of Grammys, and it is that scathing takedown of Drake. And we asked one of our producers to count the number of words that he uses in that song that he probably should avoid on a live broadcast. It's 39. I mean, should Fox be worried about this?
I honestly don't think so. You know, they knew who he was when he was booked. Kendrick has been performing on big stages for a very long time now, and he's definitely capable of performing a clean version of the track or completely reworking it. And if anything, the looming question over will he or won't he is working in Fox's favor because more people will be tuning in to see. And if all else fails, the NFL and Fox both have a 5-second delay where they can bleep out whatever they catch.
Now, considering, I mean, this is a world stage for Kendrick Lamar, Sydney. I mean, this, for a lot of people, this is going to be their first, maybe, exposure to Kendrick. So tell us about the arc of his career.
Yeah, Kendrick is considered one of the best torchbearers for the art form of hip-hop. He's a respected lyricist who's usually known for more introspective, prophetic rhymes over, you know, bouncy bops with a couple of exceptions, right? And he's released 6 studio albums in his career since he was 24. One of those albums even received a Pulitzer Prize, which is a major first in hip hop. And at Sunday's Grammys, like we said, Kendrick made history again because Not Like Us was awarded 5 Grammy Awards, including Record of the Year and Song of the Year. A diss track has never done that before. This is one of the most important shows of his career, and it's happening at a time that he's never been hotter. So after the Super Bowl, he's going to head out on tour with SZA. And after the last 8 months that he's had, it's the best forward-facing promo he could get.
All right, that's Sydney Madden of NPR Music. Sydney, who's going to win the game, Eagles or Chiefs?
I don't know. I got my bets in, but I'm keeping it close to the vest, too.
Oh, you too? All right, that's Sydney Madden of NPR Music. Sydney, thanks.
Of course. If it was up to me.
This world, I can't lie, I trust you, I love you. I won't waste your time, I turn it off just so I can turn you on. I'ma make you say it loud. I'm not even tripping, I won't stress you out.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Today, Japan's Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba will be the first Asian leader to visit the White House in President Trump's second term. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports.
Ishiba is expected to face pressure from President Trump to raise Japan's defense spending and lower its trade surplus with the U.S. Trump has harped on these points for more than three decades. Here he is talking to Oprah Winfrey in 1988.
We let Japan come in and dump everything right into our markets and everything. It's not free trade.
Ishiba can try to curry favor with Trump by offering to buy more U.S. liquefied natural gas. And he can point to Japan's commitment to roughly double defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2027. But Brad Glosserman, deputy director of the Tama University Center for Rulemaking Strategies in Tokyo, says Trump is likely to want more.
My sense is that the United States is now going to be asking for 3% at a minimum and perhaps even more. That's going to be extremely difficult for the Japanese to do because of a weak prime minister with competing national policy priorities.
Glosserman notes that Ishiba's party is in the minority in parliament, and defense hawks in his own party find him too moderate. Ishiba has long called for a more equal alliance with the U.S. Here's what Ishiba said just after President Trump's inauguration. Japan has its own national interests, and the United States has its own national interests, he told reporters. I would like to establish a relationship of trust through sincere discussions on how we can make the most of our bilateral relationship for world peace and the global economy. What neither Ishiba nor other Japanese officials will discuss publicly is their concern that the U.S. might move away from its commitment to the U.S.-Japan alliance. Yoshihide Soya, a professor emeritus at Keio University in Tokyo, voices his concern.
The Trump phenomenon is giving us a signal or warning that we should begin to think in a different sort of security paradigm.
Soya says Japan should cooperate more with other mid-sized Asian powers. He doesn't think the U.S. will turn its back on Asia, but given the direction in which America First nationalism and isolationism are currently heading, he says it might be wise for Japan to hedge its bets on its alliance with the U.S. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Long before this week's dust-up, America's trade history with Mexico was complicated. In fact, tariffs are just one way to block trade. As Jeff Guo and Eric Oberis from our Planet Money podcast show us, trade barriers take many forms.
There we are.
We recently found ourselves with potatoes piled 18 feet high. 15 million potatoes.
It's a little muddy here. So
oh my goodness.
This is literally a mountain.
It's a wall of potato.
We were in Pingree, Idaho with Brian Wada. Brian's a potato farmer who sells to just about everywhere and everyone, from Walmart to McDonald's.
But for 26 years, there was a place his potatoes did not go to, Mexico. Even though there was a free trade agreement.
That's an untapped country. And so how many times are you going to get a great marketplace that has a high population base that has never had U.S. potatoes for the most part?
The problem was this technicality, this kind of loophole in the rules of free trade. Because when two countries sign a free trade agreement, it's not like they just flip a switch and start trading. There's all these regulations that need to be worked out.
That's where Matt Lance came in. He's a trade consultant hired by the potato industry. He says of all the things he's worked on, this battle was the fight of his life.
I went from trying to promote democracy and political party building in Russia to potatoes.
What was harder?
Maybe potatoes? I don't know.
Matt says one of the basic rules of international trade is that countries have a right to protect themselves from invasive pests and diseases.
And so in the 1990s, after NAFTA was signed and the U.S. was sending fresh potatoes to Mexico, Mexico started complaining that those potatoes had too many pests.
Mexico said American potatoes could only be sent to this small region along the border.
There are border checkpoints outside of that border region, and they would stop the potatoes from going any further.
It was like a potato DMZ.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Matt says, yes, American potatoes did have some of the pests that Mexico was complaining about, and those pests could potentially devastate Mexico's crops.
But the Mexican inspectors seemed to be going a little too far. They were sending back hundreds of potato shipments, claiming they were finding all kinds of viruses and funguses and insects.
So this is getting silly.
It does sound like maybe it's not really about the pests in the first place.
Yes.
Matt says it sure seems like Mexico was using these pest complaints as an excuse to protect their own potato farmers from competition, as a sneaky form of economic protectionism.
And it wasn't just Mexico. This was happening all over the world. Quarantine issues were becoming the new way, the non-tariff barrier, the new way of keeping any product you didn't want in your country. You would just say there's a quarantine issue and you wouldn't let it in. And that would prevent market access.
As free trade was opening up in the 1990s, more and more countries started accusing each other of playing games with these pest regulations. This technicality had become a trade loophole.
And the drama between Mexico and the U.S. over potatoes continued for years. It wasn't until 2022, nearly three decades after NAFTA, that American potatoes were fully allowed in Mexico. So, when we visited Brian Wada's farm and saw his millions of potatoes, we knew that at long last, some of those are bound for Mexico.
So should we say goodbye to these potatoes?
Let's say goodbye. I'm Erica Barris.
I'm Jeff Guo, NPR News.
Goodbye, potatoes.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
Later today on All Things Considered, how New Orleans is preparing for 100,000 tourists this weekend in town for the Super Bowl amid heightened security after the New Year's Day attack. Listen live on the NPR app or your local NPR station. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Trust in me in all you do. Have the faith I have in you. Love will see us through if only you trust in me. Why don't you trust me? Come to me when things go wrong. Cling to me, Daddy. Oh, yeah, and I'll be strong. We can get along, we can get along.